Join us today in our general practice update episode where we've got loads of stuff to cover. There's been talk about general practice being paid for access or going Australian. Additionally, we've also got information about the various ICB quaff protections that are happening on CQC inspections and record access. This is a really packed episode about updating your general practice for January 2023. Let's tech enhance your primary care and learning. Hello, EGP learners, and welcome to this episode where myself and Andy are going to be updating you on everything that's been happening in general practice. And there has been quite a bit to get caught up on, though. How are we doing, first of all, Andy?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Gandy. Yeah, enjoying myself over here. Nice Saturday morning. Got my cup of tea and ready to do a Saturday morning news surgery with you. Let's get going.
Definitely. And if you are joining us live, feel free to jump in and join us. Put some comments and stuff down below. We've got lots to cover. A lot of it is recovering some previous stories that we've got updates on and stuff. But first up, we're going to be talking about basically one of the biggest stories that's been happening, and that's about charging for general practice access. And this has particularly come from our former Secretary of State for Health, Sajid Javid. Take us through it, Andy.
Yeah, so let's bring the story up. So we've selected the story from the Eye, but it's been covered in lots of publications over the course of the last week. And Sajid Javid, former health secretary, now an MP, was chancellor as well. So he's done all sorts of high jobs. So he's been quite close to the health service funding and, you know, a lot of the issues that we talk about a lot on the show. And he's suggested that the NHS in the UK could adopt a system similar to those which he sees as being successful elsewhere, where people pay for appointments and nominal charge for attending GP appointments and attending A&E, for example. So he points to the Swedish system where people pay about, I think, £20 equivalent to access these services, and in Ireland where they pay €75 to access these services as well. He has added that he would like to make these means tested, and he'd like to protect those from the poorest incomes and that they wouldn't pay. So interesting suggestions. Not been a great reception broadly to them, which I think is perhaps not unpredictable. But it's interesting because it's something that we've spoken about, not necessarily supported, but in recent episodes on the podcast and YouTube channel. I think we've said that the debate has become very, very much about access, and actually. Whereas a few years ago, people were openly talking about charges for GP appointments, for example, you know, as a reasonable thing to at least talk about, that had completely gone away. And everything was about access and ease of access and instant access. So it's interesting that this might bring that debate, you know, in a different direction. And what did you make of this story, Gandy?
I mean, it's definitely interesting. There was lots of comments about the fact, like you said, resistance in particular, and obviously the fact that actually the NHS and particularly GP access is already paid for. People do contribute to that, obviously, through taxation and stuff and the national insurance. And there's also now this additional element, which is the social and health and social care levy, which was applied from April 2022 as well. So, you know, it's not that people don't already contribute to general practice. How transparent that line of how much you pay and everything else, unfortunately, is really difficult to work out because, well, the murky and opaque elements of the, you know, government's funding and that kind of stuff and how they allocate things. But I think it's something that keeps coming back because obviously general practice capitation is a challenge in terms of how you then produce a system that can be fair and equitable and access in terms of for everybody, but also maintain continuity, which is one of the key things about general practice that is the reason why it works so well. What's really interesting, you mentioned the Northern Ireland situation and stuff. So I got interviewed by one of the radio stations for Northern Ireland a couple of weeks back because Northern Ireland are contemplating making access free for everybody. So currently I think children and certain other groups have free access, whereas, like you said, outside of that you would pay for it, and it's they have a card system. I'm afraid I don't know it in detail, and if anybody does, feel free to stick it in the comments because I would love to hear about it in more detail. But I know that there was some talk about them going to a free for everything kind of access, and obviously the concerns that people have about that kind of change. And it is mind shift, isn't it, Andy? You know, that's the key challenge with it. I think that it creates such a mind shift in the population and the workforce as well that needs to be considered as the impact that would have.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to be having the debate. I mean, the other big area where people oppose to this is just sort of based on principle, really, in terms of we have an NHS which has always been free at the point of service, and that you know enables even the poorest to have few barriers to coming forwards and accessing healthcare, and also that we're all in the same boat, so we don't have a situation where some people pay, some people don't. Those are the sorts of things that might produce some friction, you know, in society going forwards, and people's attitudes to paying large tax bills when they also have to pay at point of service and other people don't. It creates that kind of difference within society that I don't know where that would go. You know, that may be that may go to a negative place. I don't know. So I think that's the other interesting kind of aspect to it. The other thing as well is I think it's interesting to divide this out into two things, really. So I think part of this debate can be about the affordability of healthcare, and that this is money that could support healthcare delivery, particularly at those points where there's high demand, which is where the charges are levied. And then there's another side of this, which I think is the side that interests me more. I generally, I'm quite on board with payment for healthcare through taxation and, you know, doing things that way. But there's the demand management element to this as well. And actually, people suggest that if you are charging people for accessing something each time they access it, even if that money's paid back, or even if it's not sufficient to actually cover the cost of that service, then that means that you will access it only when you genuinely need it, and not at times when you don't think you need it, or you might be able to get the same outcome by accessing something else. So you might not, whereas it might be quite easy to pick up the phone and speak to your GP and ask them for some hay fever treatment, for example. You know, maybe you're better off actually going, you know, to the pharmacy. But if the cost of both of those at the point of accessing them is exactly the same, you know, one might be more easier than the other, then, you know, you might choose what is to the system the more expensive and less efficient thing, rather than what is perhaps the better thing that people should be doing in terms of getting their hay fever medication.
It's the plastic bag effect, for example.
So there's a demand management element to it. Interesting.
It's the plastic bag effect. Obviously, when plastic bags were started to be charged from supermarkets, there was a significant drop in people then only pay for plastic bags when they actually needed them or when they didn't have them and stuff. And obviously, that led to a significant change in the way that people were using plastic bags and obviously the waste that happened from that. And it's a similar principle that people think may apply to health access, and therefore people access it more when they need it rather than want it, I think, or different parts of it and stuff. What's interesting is that the chances are, if there was a paid for system, it is more likely to impact the middle class than it would any of the other population types, because as you mentioned, that they've already stated there would be some mitigation for those who don't have the income to pay, and those with excess income, you know, upper class and, you know, the really rich, to be honest, as we've seen from our prime minister, for example, you know, they probably don't really use general practice. They go private anyway. So actually it's the working and middle class that would be most heavily hit by this. And actually that's the group that's also most heavily hit currently by the cost of living increase in terms of taxation and cost increases and stuff. So actually, is it potentially penalizing those that may be most effective at having the health service working for them?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the group that sort of end up paying the bulk of tax as well. Yeah. I guess, you know, people belonging to that group would argue as well. I think the BMA have had something to say about this. So BMA chair is not in favour of this, threatening the fundamental principle of the NHS. He says, I think the BMA have pointed out that actually the NHS is underfunded compared to other countries of similar wealth, you know, other rich countries. We spend less than the average for rich countries, and we're higher than the average of rich countries in terms of wealth. And actually, this may be a case of just needing to spend more on the service. So I think those are interesting points. I mean, other things I've heard, people worry about the effect on delaying presentations, you know, of people with illness, and that actually they may delay presentation of, say, cancer symptoms or cardiovascular disease, and then turn up later with a more advanced cancer, or in A&E with a heart attack, or the effects of untreated heart disease. That a lot of appointments are for prevention, that actually the GP asks to see people a lot of the time, to do health checks, to do preventative work, you know, and how would that work with the charges, and would those appointments be exempt? Mm-hmm. And would it be just for you presenting with a new problem to your GP? So I think those are interesting points, actually. So, you know, it might actually increase costs further down the line and upstream in the health service. So I think that's interesting. And obviously people worry about the impact on the poorest of the population as well. Go on, Gandhi, you're about to come in there, I think.
I think there's also the aspect of remembering that, and I mentioned this earlier, it would require a mind shift in the way the whole system actually operates. And actually, how would practices then start taking the opportunity of charging patients? You know, what happens if a patient doesn't pay, for example? Are you going to be calling the bailiffs in on the patient because they haven't paid for the healthcare system? And I know that this is not an issue in other parts of the world where they have this, as in they've already got processes and policies that look into that. For example, you know, in America, you can go bankrupt because of health costs. Because actually they will chase you for the cost for what you have applied, because that's the way the system works over there. So, but that would require such a significant mind shift on a population basis. It's going to be really, if it was ever to happen, it actually would be a really interesting process to look at, because having that happen in a modern time, it's not really happened before. And particularly with the way that, you know, finance and everything else works currently, I think, you know, that there's a huge mind shift that would happen. And that's going to be an interesting thing, I think, to possibly observe for the history books as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And and who's going to chase them for the money? You know,
setting up the payment processes, you know, chasing them up. What if they don't pay? Does that mean you stop providing healthcare because they haven't paid? Actually, that goes completely against a lot of the principles.
How much does that cost? You know, to run that system? You know, how much is left after charging people £20 for an appointment once you've chased all those people in arrears with their payments? So people do raise that point as well. So it's interesting. I was just remembering that Rishi Sunak was mentioning charging for missed appointments as well, and there'd be a payment system required for that. So just interesting that came up in Rishi Sunak's leadership campaign. I think he was saying £10 for missed appointments,
which he then rescinded because of the pushback that came from it. As usual with, you know, unfortunately, the Tory government, they do tend to flip flop a lot on their policies, don't they? But yeah, we did see that happen.
And I think Wes Streeting, the Labour shadow health secretary, has said over my dead body. So probably predictably, you know, Labour, friend of the NHS, I guess Tories would claim to be too.
They've been a bit weird lately, but yeah, definitely more favoured, I guess, in historical books in terms of that. I guess the next thing that is aligned to this story is obviously looking at another healthcare system and some suggestions of shifting towards it. So why don't you take us through, basically, should general practice go Aussie?
Yeah, should we go Aussie? There's that program that used to run in the daytime when I was a student, where you had to flip the cards between UK and Australia or New Zealand, to stay or not to stay or something like that. So I feel a little bit like that this morning. So another place where they charge for appointments in general practice and in A&E is Australia. So that leads us into the next story, which is about the Welsh IMT conference motions are now available, and we can see what's going to be voted on at the Welsh LMC conference. One or two of the motions mention, or in fact, let's read them. So conference despairs at the thought of continuing to flog the dead horse that is our capitation based GMS contract. So paid per head, set amount per year regardless of usage. And we rejuvenate our call for GPC Wales to negotiate an activity based model, which I think is interesting. And then further they say conference urges GPC Wales to negotiate an IOS item of service fee based unified GMS contract similar to that in place in Australia. So they're referencing the Australian health system there. So Gandhi, I'm just getting to you. Just can you just explain to us, for those who don't know, the difference between capitation based payments and item of service based payments? I'm confident you can do that off the top of your head.
Sure. So capitation based systems is basically the concept that that's what we currently have. So general practice gets paid a fixed amount sum to provide healthcare to the population. So for example, if your GP practice has 10,000 patients, on average, across the UK, practices get paid about £157 per patient. So that's when you include the GMS, which is the main contract part, and then additional funding that they have. So to provide healthcare for a population of 10,000 patients, for example, that would then be, what is it? My maths head's gone.
It must be 1.5 million.
1.5 million, yeah. And that sounds like a huge amount of money, doesn't it? But don't forget, that's to run the business, that's to pay for the staff, that's to pay for all the consumables and energy costs and everything else, and basically everything that provides that service. And when you've got a business that potentially, to cover that size, you're talking about 40 employees, And obviously the access levels to provide that kind of healthcare, actually, you know, it's not as much as people may suspect. So, you know, that's how capitation works. But and it doesn't matter how many times patients use that service, you don't get paid anything additional unless it's private work or additional work outside of that. But like I said, that's the average kind of numbers we're talking about. An item of service is exactly that. So it's a transactional arrangement. So every time you have a contact or you do something, then you pay for that service. So the best example that most people probably be aware of is private healthcare itself. So if you want to see a private consultant or a healthcare clinician, general practice in private, for example, you will pay for your appointment. If you then need a blood test, you'll pay for a blood test. If you then need a prescription, you'll pay for the prescription, etc. And so every item has a cost attached to it. And then you get to choose as the consumer how much of that you also want to do based on the advice that you've had. So they're the two models. The Australian system is kind of like a hybrid of those kind of things, if I remember rightly. So there is an element that you get provided for basic amounts, and anything that you need above that is then topped up either by yourself or by insurance-based mechanisms. Unlike America, where it is all insurance-based, you have to be with an insurance provider, otherwise you pay for the full cost and then you pay for additional things on top of that. So there is kind of like a basic element that you get paid for, covered for your health. And then anything above that is then paid for by the individual. And that can be things like, for example, referrals, where you go for tests or investigations or operations and stuff, you know, other aspects and things. So that's basically the understanding of the different systems.
That's good. Yeah, I think you've done a really good job there, Gandhi. I just noticed we've got a number of people watching this morning. We're discussing what are quite controversial topics, I guess, in terms of charging for GP and A&E appointments. This item of service contract might feel a little bit academic to some people, but it actually has quite an impact in terms of how we fund the system and actually what the cost of the overall system might be, because item of service might be more expensive than the current model of payments, capitation-based model. I was going to add, I think, an interesting thing here is who is asking this question in this particular article, and it's GPs asking for a move from capitation based to item of service. So I think it's interesting just to think about why that is, and I think that's because a lot of GPs, or you know, GP partners, people who hold the GP contracts that we're talking about here, the GMS contracts, feel that the current capitation model doesn't allow them to deliver enough appointments, doesn't give them enough resources, and doesn't allow them to respond appropriately to demand. So, you know, for example, if something happens and there is a surge in interest in group A strep, for example, and there's a lot more appointments that need to be delivered, well, they're still getting the same amount of money as a year where that occurrence didn't happen. So those GP partners or other people who are partners in GP practices or own those contracts are kind of holding the risk for that, for spikes in demand, and they carry the cost for that, and the government doesn't. Whereas with an item of service contract, that risk would be held by the government, because the GP surgeries would, if there's more need for GP appointments, nurse appointments, then they would just draw down more money to reflect the increased activity that has happened. And I think a lot of GPs feel that might be a more honest way, a more practical way, and a more predictable way for running your business than the current capitation based model. That being said, there might, you know, your funding is going to go up and it's going to go down in response to changes in demand. So on the flip side, you know, we could be sat here with the situation reversed and having very different conversations, saying, oh no, we need stability for our businesses, you know, we can't cope with these spikes. So, you know, the grass isn't necessarily always greener. One thing I would say though is Australia is always attractive for people to go and work there in general practice. So I do wonder if we have some things to learn in terms of catering for what healthcare.
Absolutely. I mean, there is that whole issue that obviously, you know, we have effectively brain drain happening within the workforce at the moment. And the most common location that many GPs, hospital doctors, etc., will leave to go towards is Australia and New Zealand. That's partly down to language, culture, and that kind of stuff. But also, actually, the healthcare system is a similarity between what we have currently in the UK and various other factors. So, for example, you don't have to retake your exams and that kind of stuff. But, you know, we have a brain drain going towards that area, and there probably is something they're doing right that is helping staff want to make that choice and stuff. But therefore, that's clearly a challenge for those of us left behind. Do you want to know how to use System 1 more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, and that's the System 1 course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPPS1course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System 1 more effectively, from getting started with System 1 to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPPS1course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly. Even better yet, there's a money back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then.
And also, it sounds like they may, as you say, have a hybrid model. I've not looked at it in detail, but yeah, Actually, if there is a basic payment that can, allow your business, which is your GP practice, to ride the times of fast and famine in terms of appointments, and then there is some compensation for increasing demand. You know, maybe they have the best of both worlds there in terms of that contracting model. But interesting, and lots of interesting questions being asked about GP funding models and appointments, and I think it's good to have these debates, in my opinion.
So next we're going to talk about a slightly different type of story, and unfortunately we are talking about a organization that I don't really like talking about, but hey, it's where it's come from and stuff. So we're talking about one of the things we anticipated would happen. So a while back, obviously, the government decided they were going to publish general practice appointment data. We anticipated that we would see some naming and shaming of practices and happen, and lo and behold, the Daily Fail delivered, in terms of doing that. So they have now commented, the prospects of what practices are offering face-to-face appointments and what levels and that kind of stuff, and name and shame the 50 worst and stuff and things. Take us through it, Andy.
Yeah, so don't really like turning to the Daily Mail for our news stories, but this links into a conversation that we were having about GP appointment data and the real-time GP appointment data portal. Mm-hmm. That has been produced by the government and NHS England to show the numbers of appointments, the proportion of face-to-face appointments, and the wait, the time that people on average waited for an appointment by GP practice. It's interesting. I think at the time we predicted that this might lead to what we described as lazy, but let's use the word easy journalism stories for slow days. When you can create these clickbaity stories. This used to be a once a year occurrence that we've talked about before, when the GP survey results were released, and that used to be an annual event. They're also moving to a more real-time model. Mm-hmm. And then you used to get lots of stories in the local press, sort of what are the, we show the 10 best, in inverted commas, GP surgeries in the area. It used to be in the Nottingham Post, and everyone used to click. And then the next week they'd have, we showed the 10 worst GP surgeries. But it used to be an annual thing. But I think this can just be trotted out by journalists anytime they like because of the real-time data now. And I think the Daily Mail have done it this time. So how does your GP practice fare? It's just really appealing, isn't it, to click on for people, I guess. That's the story, really. I guess it's just that they've done it, and we predicted that they've done it. It's an interesting article because they look at some other real-time data from the NHS. So they do look at the GP appointment data, and they the most sort of compelling or clickbaity part of this is the league tables. And I'm not going to leave it on screen for very long because I don't want people to see their names there and be demoralised. It should come with a health warning for GPs. They do a map, and you can see if one of the worst performing in the various metrics they've chosen is in your area. They also draw on some other data from the NHS, and it's not all entirely negative, actually. I mean, they are, let's scroll past past that. They are actually showing that the number of face-to-face appointments is back at 70%. You know, it was 80% before the pandemic. And there may be real reasons why we've lost, you know, 10% of the face-to-face appointments, because maybe people didn't
want to do lost that amount of the workforce for a start.
Yeah, but maybe people didn't want to do, you know, maybe patients didn't want those as face-to-face appointments. You know, we don't know, but actually that's something that's improving. You know, they look at the proportion of GP appointments with a qualified doctor. I mean, that's obviously gone down because there are so many more additional, well, there's fewer GPs, but there are more additional roles working in the NHS. In the general practices due to the primary care network contract. So it's not all bad news, actually. And in some places the article is kind of neutral, but the headline is damaging, I think. Any further thoughts, Gandhi?
No, as you said, we anticipated the story would happen. It happened. No surprises which media organization decided to publish it and stuff. I think one of the things important to note, you know, there is an aspect of considering if you are in those lower ranks, you know, why are you there? Because actually some of those figures are a bit unusual. I mean, 12% face-to-face contacts, I can't really see how that would work with general practice kind of work. But, you know, I think there's definitely, you know, it's a slow news day story from our perspective. I appreciate other people may think differently of that. But, you know, it is information that can be useful, I guess, to understand where you're functioning and stuff. And the other way I would look at it, if there are practices out there that are offering, you know, really high numbers of face-to-face contacts, actually, is that also effective? You know, we talk, you know, some people think that having lots and lots and always having face-to-face contacts is the best thing to happen. Actually, I would argue it may not be. You know, it doesn't mean that just because you're the lowest, that's really bad. Okay, it doesn't sound great. But also if you're the opposite end, if you're all face-to-face contact, actually, is that the best way to deliver healthcare as well? You know, I would say being in the middle is probably a happy medium as usual. But actually, you know, I think it's worth looking at it from all sides of the coin as well.
Yeah, I would add, just having looked at the league table, I won't put it on screen, but actually look, no, they put it, take it away. We don't want to upset people, but looking at some of the names there, I'm just aware that it can be so demoralizing for these surgeries. But looking at the types of names, actually, I can see a few sort of familiar names, actually. So we won't name them, but well-known providers of online appointments, you know, are there, you know, organizations that we've talked about before, and their whole selling point is that they provide low numbers of face-to-face and high numbers of online appointments. You know, they're there. Some of the surgeries sound like they're quite bespoke. So there's a care home service, and, you know, you wonder if that's a telemedicine service for care homes or something that they do. So there might be reasons why people are there, as you say. The other point I was just going to make before we close on this was, you know, obviously it's difficult to see these stories, but in terms of making the data available and allowing practices to reflect on their data, you know, I do ask the question, will this eventually lead to better data quality? So more standardized reporting of appointment types and more, you know, realistic reporting of appointment types, because there is an incentive now for practices to report that properly and to report on their activity. And will that eventually lead to an improvement in patients' needs being met and the appointment mix being appropriate to their population? And, you know, maybe it will. You know, often we're afraid of these of data being published initially, but there is something about it potentially driving quality, and I think maybe in the end this is something that we will learn to live with, and it's something that won't be too bad, although we'll suffer these stories every now and again from journalists.
We will. And I guess, you know, just to add to that particular commentary, that, you know, one of the important things to remember is how accurate actually is the data itself. You know, there's been lots laid at the sense that, so they use what's called the GPAD data, the GP appointment data. We know that the data is flawed because the data that's published only reports on a small amount of that was actually captured. And it's been a significant criticism of the whole process that it only reports on particular parts of the data sets that are captured and things. So all that additional work that happens in general practice, that is not published by NHS Digital in that particular data. So it is a misrepresentation of what actually happens in general practice. But obviously it's the part that, as ever, certain parts of the media love to focus on, because it's great for a slow news day and great for a way of, you know, adding commentary to a political situation, isn't it?
Absolutely. Gandhi, we've had a comment from one of our regular viewers that asks an interesting question as well. I'm just wondering if bringing on screen might be helpful. So JC Melody has just made a comment really about hybrid system, you know, of sorts offering flexibility. So I think she may be considering that there might be some merits in this, you know, mm-hmm. I privately pay for scans if the wait is too long to ease pressure elsewhere. And that's something that a lot of people talk about. I think Margaret Thatcher made that point when she said that she used private healthcare back in the 80s. She felt that that's mm-hmm. pressure elsewhere. The other question she asked Andy was, have you two ever thought about relocating? I mean, have you thought about going to Australia, Gandhi, or anywhere like that? Just a quick ask.
I won't deny that I've thought about it. I think logistically for me, the family ties and that kind of stuff make it something that wouldn't be something I would want to consider, just because of that reason. So I mentioned earlier, you know, Australia and New Zealand tend to be the favourite ones because of culture being fairly similar to British culture, language, key issue and stuff for many people, and lifestyle. Yeah, and the fact you don't have to redo the exams. But I think for me, you know, like for many people currently working in the NHS, there are certain ties that just mean that you want to stay where you are. But yeah, I won't deny the thought has crossed my mind on a few occasions. What about yourself, Andy?
Welcome to Inspiring Computing. This podcast is where computing meets the real world. Inspiring Computing aims to trigger your curiosity by talking to proficient and advanced MATLAB, Python, and Julia users who use these tools to deepen their understanding of the world around them by simulating it, exploring trade-offs, and gaining insights that help their companies add more value. In addition to proficient users, we will be talking to product marketing, toolbox authors, package developers, and library maintainers to see what drives their development and what issues they're solving for others to benefit from.
Yeah, it's not something I would think about now. I've thought about it earlier in the career. I think sometimes you get to a stage where you know the system, you know how things work locally, and you've actually got friends, you know, and contacts and people who work locally within the UK and within your local system. And actually the cost of rebuilding that becomes a disincentive to going elsewhere. And also, I'm not too down on the UK, actually, as a place. Obviously, there's challenges. I think there's challenges in other places as well. And yep. You know, I quite like where the UK is. You can hop on a plane and go to really interesting you know, European cities on breaks. There's lots of culture in Europe, you know. Yep. So I actually quite like living in Europe. Maybe it's a shame we're not part of the union, but never mind. So there we go. That's your question, JC.
Yeah, and I guess there's always that concept the grass may always look greener on the other side as well. So we don't know the challenges that they face in other parts of the country, in parts of the world and stuff like that. So yeah.
So I suppose the next few stories are updates on things that we've been following and covering over time. I don't know if you want to talk about the next one, Gandhi. ICB's agreed to pay protection QoF.
So this is something that's come up a couple of times in our updates. So this whole concept of QoF protection. So just to remind everybody who may not be aware of what it is, so QoF is the Qualities and Outcome Framework. It's an additional part of payments that happens to general practice for doing certain parts of work. So for example, things like blood pressure checks, diabetes management, you know, chronic diseases, the main bulk of it, but there are other parts like, for example, QoF QI, so improvement work and things like access and patients with dependence forming medications and various other things that happen. That forms the second largest quotient of amount of funding that general practices receive, first one being, you know, their main core funding. But this is often a sizable amount of funding. And for most practices, you're talking upwards of about, you know, tens of thousands of pounds worth of income, which actually, if they didn't have them, they couldn't pay for staff. The reason why this has become an issue is that a lot of it is based on doing certain checks and balances with patients' healthcare. And obviously, with what we've seen with the acute demand spiraling, particularly in the past few months, obviously, in order to make capacity to cover the acute demand, it's this kind of stuff that suffers and therefore you can't maintain it. And as a result of that, therefore, you are unlikely to hit the various targets, which obviously you are paid based on whether you hit those targets or not. So a lot of places have been saying to their local systems, if you want us to provide more capacity in general practice to deal with the acute demands and the pressures in secondary care and all the other aspects of the healthcare system, which are failing at the moment, then, you know, we have to make a choice, because if we're asked to pivot to help with that, we're not going to have the income from QoF, which actually without that income, many practices will probably not be able to keep their doors open, because it's that much of a factor for those practices and stuff. So in some areas, the ICB, so the organisations that now control how your healthcare is delivered for your local area, have offered payment protection for Quaff. So the first area to deliver that was Devon, according to the article. And, you know, they were quite pushing it. Obviously, there was some pushback from NHS England about this. And I think a lot of that may have been misconstrued, because I think from my understanding, the pushback from NHS England was very much that they can't suspend Quaff. Technically, it requires a change in law to do that, which did happen on the previous 2 years because of COVID vaccination plans and various other things. So that did happen. But this year, they haven't applied for the change of law that requires that to happen on a national basis. So you can't talk about Quaff being suspended, because that's a very specific thing. But what the ICBs in these particular areas, so I think it was Devon, Cambridgeshire, Peterborough, Norfolk, a couple of other places, have basically said that we will offer an element of payment protection for practices to equate to, you know, funding they would have got on previous years for Quaff, on the basis that you're now covering the extra acute demand that's happening. Some places have gone full to coverage, some places have gone partial and still asking practices to do some elements of Quaff. And I know that's what's happened to us in Nottingham, hasn't it, Andy? So the Nottinghamshire ICB have said that we will cover about, I think it's about 70-80% of Quaff, but there are some criteria that they have said that actually that still needs to continue, you need to be addressing and stuff, which has had mixed responses in that kind of approach. Because there is that aspect of, obviously, this is still health that we want to manage for our patients. Interestingly, I know my perspective, the Nottingham one, that the criteria they kept in is very much the criteria that only GPs can do. So actually, it hasn't really released much capacity, because it's only the GPs that can do that particular part. Whereas obviously a lot of this stuff can be done by other members of the healthcare team, like our nurses, physios, pharmacists and stuff. Actually, the parts that were kept in by Nottingham is very much the GP heavy workload kind of stuff. But, you know, I think making attempts is always a positive thing to support practices, particularly with the challenges we've all been facing. But it does raise the question, this is now potentially 3 years on the trot that Quaff has been suspended or paused or you know, protected and other things. Should it continue? Is it worthwhile?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I was thinking the same thing, Andy, and I think we've said as much before when they were talking about pausing Quaff for another year. You know, this probably begins to look like a system that cannot cope, and that the business as usual is not sustainable. And I think you either need to, you know, increase the funding, increase the people, you know, something that structurally improves the capability of the system to deliver, or you need to sort of change the expectation and the incentives. So interesting.
And we've got an interesting comment from Ritu Prasad. So she mentions that removing Quaff, unfortunately, likely to result in long-term conditions, LTC diseases, not annually monitored, no partial financial protection in London. So interesting that from what her comments, that London hasn't taken that approach. I know that London obviously has a different diverse system because of various different ICBs in that particular area. So it's unlikely to be a unified decision. But yeah, I think that's always been one of the concerns, that if Quaff was removed, what would happen to long-term condition monitoring? Because obviously practices are, basically monitored on how much they do, and that's how they receive the income. At the same time, often there's always been criticism that a lot of the Quaff, administration side of it is very much tick boxing. You know, it's stuff that we do, but if you haven't ticked the box, then you don't get paid for it and stuff. And you know, may contribute to some of that, you know, concept of, box ticking of healthcare and unnecessary preventative appointments and that kind of stuff, versus actually maintaining the health of the local population and stuff. So interesting comment. Thank you for that, Ritu.
Yeah, thanks, Ritu. Yeah, and I think we've previously said it, we would expect that it would need to be replaced by something to maintain standards in primary care for management of long-term conditions. And I've often wondered if we might see an expansion of the CQC safety searches, or, you know, a monitoring dashboard that we're not funded for, but we're penalised against the performance. You
know, so I think that's one of the concerns that if Quaff ever went, that they wouldn't replace it, they would just get rid of the funding and you know, not change it and stuff, which is actually, you know,
rolling into GMS people talk about, don't they?
Okay,
so the next story is perhaps a little bit more positive in a way.
CQC,
so talking about CQC. So again, just in case you haven't heard, essentially CQC have announced that they are suspending routine inspections in general practice until March. essentially, this is in response to the pressure on general practice to deal with the current NHS crisis, if we're allowed to use the C word here. No one uses it within government bodies. They are going to inspect where they think that there's a risk to patients. So the sort of highest risk sort of concerns will still be inspected, and they're going to be using intel from local NHS bodies and their sort of continuous data monitoring that they do to identify where risks are arising. And just obviously, if you work in sort of dental, mental health, adult social care, you know, anywhere that isn't NHS out of hours 111 or general practice, then inspections will continue as planned. So it was really just to update you on that. Again, this is an area that they keep suspending inspections, don't they, due to the pressure. So maybe this is an indication of a system that isn't sustainable. I think, not sure if I'd use the word, I would use the word crisis, but others don't. Any further thoughts on this, Gandhi?
Again, it raises the validity of the CQC inspections themselves as a process, if this is the view that obviously the system takes, that, you know, I think absolutely it was a right to suspend routine inspections. I think that, you know, many people feel CQC has a varying lens that it looks at general practice, and the standardization is always a question that keeps coming up as well. So I think, you know, there probably does need to be more of a look at what CQC's function is in current healthcare, I think. I know the organisation would feel that it absolutely has a place to exist and stuff. Okay, fair enough. Most organisations would. But I think there is that aspect of how does it work within the system based on the outputs and stuff that I think is a really interesting thing that may need to happen at some point in the future.
Absolutely. But suspended until March is the take home message here.
And then for our next story. So many people remember the whole concept of record access being a hot topic repeatedly. And back in November, obviously, it was coming to a head with a general practice record access being made open access to all. It then got paused again. I think this is now the fourth or fifth time it got paused. And many practices submitted their request not to have the access happen en masse. I think in a control mechanism, it absolutely is a sensible thing, and then there's an opt-in, an absolutely sensible thing to do. But open access for all at a time, particularly when these challenges that we've already highlighted were there, obviously that was felt to be too much of a pressure situation. Just a quick note to state that because of some of the contractual stuff that's happened, for those practices that have not opted out on system one, that your record access will now be switched on en masse from the 1st of February. Which is obviously next week at the time of us filming this and stuff. So this does not mean that if you have opted out that your records will be available to all patients automatically from the 1st of February. It is if you haven't done, and I believe it's just over 900 practices from the estimation that is due to go live. About 600 plus practices have already switched on their record accesses. So we're talking about 1,500 out of the 7,000 plus currently across the country. But it's just to be aware of this fact, and obviously the record access is switching on from the 1st of February for those practices if you have not already submitted the relevant access codes and stuff to not let that happen en masse. That's the key thing, because I appreciate some patients watching this maybe thinking, why wouldn't you want to do that? The key issue I think many practices have, it's about every patient having automatic access without any checks and balances, because actually there are some situations where that is not safe or appropriate, and it is likely to create an excessive amount of workload for practices to manage. And as well as obviously because of GDPR regulations and various information governance stuff, there is significant implications in terms of this happening en masse for an entire population that you may be looking after.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, and not to spend too much time on it, you know, GP practices have an obligation, as I think we're the data controller, I think, yep, or owner. I think it's controller. We're the data controller. So there's obligations to GDPR regulation and the information thingy agency. I forgot what it's called. But essentially, we've got obligations to protect people from harmful data. So data that might be harmful to them, and to not allow situations to exist where people can access data about other people that might be stored within data about them or within their health records. So phone numbers for other people, other professionals in hospital. You know, sometimes these things are recorded from an expediency perspective in medical notes, or traditionally have, because they've generally been for within the profession. So it allows somebody else to pick up that number and, you know, use it in future. But it's not appropriate for that to be released to the patient, because that's someone else's data. So there's also, and there are fines, you know, for getting this wrong. Yeah. So and to get this right takes time and workforce. And if we already alluded to, a lot of routine activity has had to, you know, worthwhile routine activity has to be paused due to pressures. So was this the right time to do it? You know, we've had these debates before, and I think between the two of us, we probably articulated the main points again this morning. Look out, it will be switched on. If you've not made a proactive decision yourself in your system or practice, it will be switched on 1st of February.
And if you did want some tips to help patients understand that, you are welcome to check out some of the content that we've got on EGP Learning. So we've got particular videos about, you know, that you can share with patients about how to access their records. We've also got videos about how to do the whole information sharing aspects in System 1 in particular, obviously with our System 1 content. And obviously we've got the playlist for System 1 that anyone can access free of use, as well as the course for clinicians that's always available on EGP Learning as well. So Andy, we've covered loads of topics today, massive amounts of content that's been happening. Just to let everybody know, me and Andy had a rather interesting trip recently. We went down to Google to a YouTube health event, and that's going to be what comes up in our content next week. So to cover basically what's been happening and what you may want to know about how YouTube is planning on helping the health system. And they do have some plans to help with it, actually, rather interesting ones. So me and Andy had a really interesting trip, and we're going to be feedbacking our reflections on that particular trip. And if you want to check that out, have a look at the video coming up about here right now. I always forget which way around this stuff is and stuff. And as always, we're here to help tech enhance your primary care and learning. And we will definitely catch you in the next episode. And have a great weekend, everyone. See you later. Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, to tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.